Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today we'll visit Bates College in Lewiston for a recent panel discussion on climate change, titled Dealing with Climate Change, The Debate Among Policymakers. If you enjoy this program and would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting our website, mpbn.net, and looking under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen. There you'll find Audio On Demand, and a list of available programs, including this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the panel is David Scobie, director of the Harwood Center for Community Partnerships at Bates College.
Welcome, everyone. I'm delighted that you've come to tonight's civic forum on dealing with climate change, the debate among policymakers. I'm David Scobie, director of the Harwood Center for Community Partnerships here at Bates. The Harwood Center is the host for tonight's discussion and for the whole Civic Forum series. Our mission at the center is to weave civic engagement throughout the Bates education by coordinating and catalyzing community-based learning and research, co-curricular community service, and environmental stewardship. We're lucky to have such a rich mix of experience and expertise for this panel on climate change policy. I'm going to introduce all four of our panelists now in the order in which they'll speak, and then I'll get out of the way of the discussion. And they're seated in the order in which they'll speak. To my far right, Ted Kaufman will open the panel by framing the larger climate change issue for us, including a bit of an overview on international research on the effects of global warming and our current understandings of its impact on Maine. Ted is the executive director of Maine Audubon, and prior to that, he served four terms in the Maine legislature, serving as the House Chair of the Joint Committee on Natural Resources, where he sponsored the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI, Maine's Carbon Cap and Trade Program. Ted was also Director of Government Relations for the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor. Tom Teitenberg will give us an overview of some of the key policy proposals with which environmental experts and advocates have responded to climate change, including cap-and-trade and carbon tax proposals. Tom taught environmental and resource economics at Colby for 35 years before retiring in 2008, and despite that, we're happy to welcome him here. He was the team leader for the United Nations project that laid the foundations for the emissions trading mechanism and other components that went into the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, as well as a panel member of the National Academy of Science Study, America's Climate Choices. He serves as a trustee for Maine's Energy and Carbon Savings Trust. After Tom, Melissa Carey will talk about the particular policy proposals and the political forces shaping the current cap-and-trade legislation in Congress. Melissa leads the climate change policy work for the Environmental Defense Fund, one of the most important national environmental research and advocacy groups. She's an expert on market-based environmental protection and has worked closely with both state and congressional staffs on environmental policy. And finally, Pete Dittesheim will offer an overview of the issues raised in the panel, including focusing on the implications of climate change policy for the state of Maine. Pete has served since 1996 as advocacy director for the National Resources Council of Maine. Before that, he served in a variety of national policy positions on energy technology and in the environment in the U.S. Department of Energy and the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. Here in Maine, he has served as a leader on the Penobscot River Restoration Project and a board member of the Maine League of Conservation Voters. It's a wonderful panel, and I look forward to hearing them. Ted.
Thank you, David. Well, I'm very happy to be here. This is my second visit to speak at Bates on a panel, one of my favorite schools. Fortunately, at College of the Atlantic, we didn't have to compete with you in soccer or any other sport. I'm going to give an overview of the climate issue as we experience it in Maine. And before I get started, I want to recommend to you, if you haven't seen it yet, the University of Maine's Climate Institute report called Maine's Climate Future. Have any of you read that book yet? Well, that's good. So one of us has. Two of us have. But it's a terrific piece that was requested by Governor Baldacci. It was printed in February of this year. and it really covers very cogently, very clearly, very readable piece that describes how climate change may affect Maine in this century. And I'm going to address some of the issues that they bring up. You can find this report on their website, www.climatechange.umaine.edu. It's a great institute. I have a little bias toward it. My daughter's working on a PhD there in climate studies, and I know if she ever hears this program, she'll be correcting my remarks, but I'm used to that. How many of you have seen Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth film? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, fortunately, I'm not going to go over all the fundamentals of climate science as it's come to lay the foundation for our understanding about this issue in the years ahead. But I'm glad you've seen it, and I'm sure that the radio audience has probably seen it as well. I'm going to ask myself and try and answer several questions in sort of framing the issue in Maine. One is, of course, how might climate change impact Maine's natural resources, our economy, and our quality of life? How has our species, through its history, responded to seemingly insurmountable severe crises and changes and threats? Should we vigorously work to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions now and into the future, or focus on the importance of adaptation strategies in response to changes evident today and changes that will continue taking place in the years ahead? That's a trick question for any of you who are studying climate change. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "This time, like all times, is a very good one if we but know what to do with it." And of course, this time doesn't feel like all times. We've entered the climate change era, and we need to figure out what to do about it. Climate change models suggest a temperature increase of 4 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit in this century. The literature explains that unchecked increasing CO2 will surely produce ecological, social, and economic dislocation. Assuming we can avoid the extreme possibilities, this period of transformation can also provide opportunities. Investments aimed to transition from a fossil fuel-based economy will bring great opportunities to strengthen our economy, introduce new jobs, and build healthier ways of living. A co-benefit of reducing fossil fuel use, as you all know, will be cleaner air to breathe, far less mercury contaminating our waters and wildlife and impacting our forests. In 2003, when I was serving as chair of the Natural Resources Committee, we had a climate bill come before the committee, and the president of the Maine Maple Syrup Producers Association, who lived in Skowhegan, provided testimony on the bill. And he described how recent fluctuations in winter and spring temperatures were impacting syrup production. And I thought that was a wonderful metaphor for the larger problem we may face here. He has good reason to be concerned, because according to the Climate Institute report, the mix of tree species and species diversity within forest types are expected to change in this century. Climate change will introduce insects and diseases, resulting in growth losses and dieback that could profoundly affect the forest products industry. And I can say as an aside that they're having their own discussions about how to prepare and adapt for that changing forest. Yet there may be new opportunities for that industry to create new products from a different forest resource. Speaking of diseases, some of us have been treated for Lyme disease. I just finished a series of antibiotics for that. And many of us probably know someone who's afflicted by it. Those of us who raise vegetables and flowers have enjoyed a longer growing season. Spring is coming earlier, winter later. On the other hand, ice fishermen, snowmobilers, and skaters are noticing that safe ice is formed a week or two later in the winter, and ice out takes place 2 weeks earlier in the spring. Interesting research done in Maine looking at family diaries going back into the 1850 era and up through current times, meticulously recording ice in and ice out on their lake or pond throughout New England, including Maine. And so we have a very interesting model to look at. Ski area managers, of course, are aware that climate change may bring more rain than snow in the decades ahead. They have concerns about that. Over the last several years, we've seen an uptick in severe 24-hour rainfall events, and we've observed the damage done to road systems whose gutters and culverts are overwhelmed by flows that they were not designed to manage. We will find an engineering solution to this problem as we adapt, but it won't be inexpensive. And if you've driven around after some of these major rain events and countryside roads, the extent of miles of washout are really quite extraordinary and very expensive. And I asked someone at the Maine Municipal Association who I thought might keep records of this sort of thing across the state, and they haven't. So it's all, you know, each town knows what its tax rate has to do to adjust for those new expenses, but we haven't looked at it as a whole. And we're experiencing more severe spring runoff. So the melt is happening earlier, and the rush of spring water coming off is more significant. But then that's followed by lower stream flows later in the season that are stressing freshwater species, like my favorite, the brook trout. Sea levels could rise by 2 or more feet by 2100. Warming oceans are absorbing CO2 and becoming more acidic, which contributes to the stresses on coral reefs and shellfish. So there's a question out there about how lobsters will respond to changing ocean chemistry and temperature, and what new marketable species may enter our waters that will feel more comfortable here. Now, as you know, because many of you are environmental studies majors, scientists are explaining that climate is a dynamic, oscillating system with 100,000-year cycles. And through the billions of years of planet history, a wide variety of climate conditions have dominated. There is no normal temperature on Earth, I'm told by the geologists, no normal climate. I grew up thinking that climate was always this way, but it wasn't. Elizabeth Colbert, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, points out that the only period in climate record as stable as our own is our own. Think about that. For nearly 10,000 years, we've enjoyed what is aptly described, and I quote, a long summer whose warmth and stability the world has not seen for 500,000 years. The Earth's thermostat, having settled at a comfortable average of 57 degrees Fahrenheit, has provided an interlude of optimal living conditions during which we've developed agriculture and modern civilizations. This is in contrast to earlier climate periods that were far less favorable to humans, including periodic inhospitable ice ages covering the northern latitudes. At a time when scientists continue discovering new species around the world, climate models point to a loss of 30% of existing species as the levels of CO2 continue to climb in the decades ahead. Seemingly small changes in temperature have serious consequences. And I know how I feel when my temperature goes up a few degrees above 98.6. This new and surprising challenge, the climate change era, seems different in scale and complexity from anything we've experienced as a species. Reversing greenhouse gas emissions will require social and economic transformations that could lead to improvements over the status quo we live in today, perhaps. If necessity is the mother of invention, we have lots of inventing ahead. Our species has survived nature's challenges, ice ages lasting millennia, volcanoes and hurricanes and tsunamis and severe droughts and plagues and pandemics have wreaked havoc, periodically erasing whole civilizations. Survivors are forced to adapt, to transform themselves, and create a new normal. The Middle Ages faced devastating plagues, we all know that. But some regions in Europe were able to make the connection between famines that weakened the population and plagues that thrived on the weak. In order to avoid plagues, new marriage customs were established, delaying marriage until couples inherited land to sustain a family, avoid famine and plague. I always found that quite remarkable back in the 13th century, that connection could be understood and you would actually change the family dynamic and when you're allowed to marry. And the penalties were quite harsh for breaking those rules. The 1916 pandemic killed 100 million people around the world. Public health lessons learned from that experience have since averted many public health threats, and these lessons are applied today with H1N1. Last weekend, Maine Audubon celebrated the 40th anniversary of its birding cruises on the Kennebec River. We come up from the ocean upriver. And when we offered the first trip in 1969, the river was used as an open sewer for untreated municipal and industrial waste. Few people then could have imagined how these rivers would respond to the Clean Water Act, introduced by Senator Edmund Muskie. The act transformed the Androscoggin and Kennebec, along with hundreds of rivers across the nation that seemed hopelessly polluted. Saturday's trip also celebrated the restoration of the bald eagle in Maine. 40 years ago, DDT was impacting eagle reproduction, and passengers on that 1969 trip saw one pair of eagles. Back then, the whole state only had two pairs of nesting eagles. In 1972, in part to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, we banned DDT in the country. It took 25 years for DDT to break down in the environment, but eventually the eagle population responded. Last Saturday, we saw 23 eagles, and there are now nearly 500 nesting pairs of eagles in Maine. The ban on DDT transformed circumstances, allowing eagle, peregrine falcon, osprey, and other bird species to thrive again. A cap-and-trade program on sulfur dioxide pollution introduced in the 1980s reduced that pollution by 70%. And we're going to talk about successful cap-and-trade programs that reward innovation, efficiency, and early action while providing strict accountability without inhibiting economic growth. These and other hard-fought policy initiatives reverse long-term behavior patterns that tend to degrade environment and public health. While the prospect of new innovative alternative energy technologies coming online is exciting and significant, I liked visiting wind tower farms and seeing these dramatic pieces of engineering going up on the landscape. I think they're quite beautiful, a little bit like a dance on tops of the trees. We already have many technical tools, and we understand the incentives and disincentives that could reduce CO2 emissions. Sometimes I think the real issue is will, political will. Added together, many individual policy tools and initiatives can contribute to major progress on emission reduction adaptations. I won't go through the long list, but certainly transforming our transportation system and methods would be a great accomplishment. That would require significant federal investments in mass transit and light rail, but we're beginning to see that in the country. Some of the states are beginning to fund their own systems, those that have any money. There are disincentives for burning fossil fuels and incentives to invest in alternative energy. I'm particularly excited with the feed-in tariff that's applied in Germany and Portugal. And we, of course, if you read the papers, we have a delegation in Europe now looking at wind energy programs there. But the feed-in tariff is particularly intriguing to me because individuals will be paid a premium for the amount of electricity beyond what they consume. They get a premium above the standard price of electricity. And there are whole communities in Germany that have come together and passed bond issues for their community, not rich communities, working, farming communities, who have erected towers, put out solar voltaics and whatnot, and many of them have a retirement fund that now is coming from those premiums. So I'm very optimistic about the future. Lewis Mumford, the anthropologist, said about probabilities, I'm a pessimist. About possibilities, I'm an optimist. And I'm optimistic, especially with your generation. For the radio audience, I'm looking at a bunch of folks under 30, most of us. While our generation may not get this job done, we'll do our very best to position our country for you to finish the job if we don't get it done. Thank you very much.
I want to congratulate the Harwood Center for sponsoring this panel discussion, in my opinion, for the reasons that Ted has just articulated, and I would also say for reasons that we don't even understand yet, because this is a sufficiently complex problem. Climate change will probably be one of the most important problems that you, as today's college-age generation, will face over the course of your lifetime. So I think it's commendable for the Harwood Center to sponsor this. The two policies that seem to dominate the discussion nationally and even internationally now are cap and trade and carbon taxes. And I wanted to make sure that we were all on the same page before we actually launched into a more detailed discussion of that. A tax approach basically tells an emitter that they can emit as much as they want. But, and here's the catch, they have to pay a per unit tax on every unit they emit. $20, for example, is a common number mentioned. A cap and trade is really quite different in that sense because it puts an annual upper limit in tons on the aggregate amount of emissions by all of the covered entities that fall under the program. And then it creates a set of one-ton allowances. The sum of that number equals the cap, so it's prorating this ability to emit one ton. And then the allowances are allocated either by auctioning, that is to the highest bidder, or by gifting, which is giving them to the recipients on the basis of some eligibility criterion. At the end of the year, every emitter is required to submit and surrender a number of allowances that's equal to their actual emissions. So by setting the cap and setting these allowances, you actually control the total amount of emission reduction that goes out. Now, I just want to make sure that you understand the fundamental point here, because most of what follows will sort of depend on this. And that is, notice that a tax approach fixes the price and leaves the reduction to the market, the size of the emission reduction to the market. Whereas the opposite is true for a cap and trade. A cap and trade controls the emission reduction and leaves the price to the market. So in some sense, they're kind of mirror images of each other. Given how many different policy options exist, one question is, why do cap and trade and carbon taxes get so much press? I think there are several reasons for that, but I happen to think the main reason for that is that they are the only two policies which are compatible with cost-effective incentives. And what that means basically is that you can either, compared to a policy that's not cost-effective, you can achieve the same goal at a lower cost with a cost-effective policy, or you can spend the same amount of money and get much more environmental quality than you're getting with the non-cost-effective policy. So it's actually pretty important. And empirical studies indicate that the savings from moving to a non-cost-effective policy to a cost-effective policy are in the neighborhood of 30 to 50% frequently. And there are some that are higher than that. So it clearly is worth trying to be cost-effective. Now, when we move to carbon taxes and cap and trade, it turns out that what you rarely hear is the fact that many of the things that have to be decided are exactly the same for those two policies. And I think that's an important point for you to understand. And I'm just going to share a few of them with the time limits. We can't go into any detail, which you probably wouldn't want to do anyway. But I'm going to note some of them just to illustrate the point. The first is you have to decide what gases are covered. Almost all of the discussion controls considers CO2. CO2 is a greenhouse gas, but it's only one of them. The Kyoto Protocol has six greenhouse gases in it, for example. And so frequently these policies can control multiple gases, not just CO2. And they do that by making them, all of the other gases in terms, ranked in terms of their relative contribution to global warming relative to CO2. So it creates a kind of index of equal radiative forcing contributions of these gases. That means for a cap and trade system, for example, that the allowance is defined usually in terms of a carbon dioxide equivalent as opposed to just carbon dioxide. And in terms of a tax, the tax base is taxing carbon dioxide equivalents. And for those of you who are studying in this area, I would remind you that when you see data about carbon, about the greenhouse problem, remember to look at whether it calls it CO2 or CO2e. Because if it's CO2e, it means it's equivalent, and that means it's a multi-gas system, and it makes quite a difference. So it's worth knowing what you're looking at. The next question is, what sources are covered? And the answer there basically depends in part on whether you're using what's called an upstream system or a downstream system. An upstream system actually tries to get at the fuels that are used, the carbon in the fuels that are used, and controls the carbon that way, whereas the downstream system actually controls the emission points, like the power plants and so on. You also can have a system which controls both at the same time. And in fact, there's a movement now to try to get as far upstream as possible, because for controlling things like automobile emissions and so on, it's sort of easier to do it that way than it is downstream. The big question, and the one that is a major issue related to the national cap and trade issue, is allocating the entitlements to use the sky as a waste repository. Who gets that entitlement and at what price, and who owns the sky is a subtext of this. In the system where the government gets all the revenue from that, the implicit assumption is the government owns the sky. But when you give these allowances away, the assumption is the emitter owns the sky. I think it's a different and interesting case. So in taxes, the issue of entitlements is determined by the tax rate and by who gets exemptions. The way you treat special interests in a tax system is that if you think they are vulnerable to tax increases, then you give them a tax exemption. In an allowance system, if you think they deserve special treatment, then they get a gifted allowance. That means they don't have to pay for it. They get it for free. Analysis suggests, however, that the auction system is far superior in both efficiency terms, which means not wasting resources, or in terms of fairness. And I have a little bit more to say about that. So the push in academic circles is always for 100% auctioning. And the REGI system, the main part of the REGI system, has 100% auctioning. And that was the first time that carbon allowances had been auctioned off in that way, to that degree. And so it was actually a major step, and I think has been one of the reasons why REGI has been sort of influential beyond the borders of the Northeast. The question then is, if these funds raise revenue, and they really raise revenue, because we're talking about a lot of carbon, which means a lot of money, then what do you do with it? And the answer is that that's the thing that makes auctions and taxes so valuable, because they generate this revenue, and the revenue can do two major things. One is that it can increase the efficiency of the system, and I can go into more detail on that if you'd like in the question period. But probably politically even more important than that is the fact that it can make the system a whole lot fairer. Generally, economists say that a tax system or a cap-and-trade system are highly regressive. That's economist speak, and it's economist speak for the poor getting hit harder than everybody else. And so the only way you can correct that problem is to use the revenue from these systems to provide rebates. There are all kinds of, you can lower payroll taxes. Again, in the questions, we can get into the specific ways and what we know about them. But there are several ways to use that revenue to bring the poor so that they, too, can participate in this transition to a better planet. The REGI money, for your interest, is all used for energy efficiency, which also has fairness consequences, and that is because if you help people, the first REGI money, for example, was spent on weatherizing low-income homes. So if people have weatherized low-income homes, they're buying less of this energy, which saves them money, which reduces the regulatory burden on them. One of the other big controversies beside allocations in this system is the role for offsets, or in the case of tax offset, tax credits. And what this means is that you have someone who reduces carbon off-site, that is, off your site, somewhere else. And then if that reduction is not usually not covered by the cap. And then once that reduction is certified, it can be traded to somebody under the cap, and they can use it like an allowance. And so these offsets have one characteristic is that when you allow offsets, they reduce the cost of meeting these environmental goals by a lot, actually. The disadvantage of offsets is that they're much harder to regulate and enforce than allowances. And so you can, if it's not done carefully, threaten the environmental integrity of the entire system by allowing too many offsets that are not well enforced. And that is a major issue that we're dealing with now. If you need an example of what an offset might be like methane from landfills. That's not covered by the cap, but if you claim the methane from the landfill, then that could be served as an offset, because methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. In fact, more powerful than carbon dioxide. So these offsets can be used both to reduce the tax base, or they can be used as allowances, and it lowers the cost, but it raises questions of environmental integrity. So it's a interesting political decision. Let me compare. Those are all things which are in common with these systems. Let me now compare some of the differences. First of all, linking to the historical system. We in this country have been using cap and trade, or at least emissions trading, which is its predecessor, since 1975. And that's a long time, so we have a lot of experience with that. We have never used taxation for this kind of purpose. And so in this country, the historical experience is different than it is in Europe, who has used taxation regularly to control pollution. But more important than that, perhaps, is think about how these systems relate to the goals. The goals are all stated in quantitative terms. Whenever you see goals, they are frequently, for example, the most common one now is reduction of 80% by 2050, reduction of emissions. Now, what that means is that if you have that goal, it's a relatively easy step to simply set that for the cap, because you know what the emissions were in the base year. You subtract 80% for that, that gives you an allowed emissions, and that's the cap. So the link is very, very simple to go from goal to policy. Now let's take a tax policy. You go and you know what the reduction you want is. What's the price that accomplishes that? I'm not sure. And that's part of the problem. We can forecast what it might be, but we don't really know. Remember back to the step when I said the difference is that in one case we set the emission reduction and we let the market set the price, or we set the price and let the emission reduction fall out. So the question of determining the tax is really difficult. In fact, one proposal that's out there is you start with cap and trade, and what it turns out that there's an equivalence between the cap and trade price and the tax that you would use to achieve that goal. And so once you use cap and trade to establish those prices, then you can actually establish a tax because you know what the tax rate is. And there are actually some proposals in that kind of regard. The second issue is basically feasibility. Most observers, I believe, at least in the U.S., believe that the cap and trade is more politically feasible than the carbon tax. And in part, the reason for that is that in the U.S., tax is, converse to logic, a four-letter word. And so taxes are really an anathema to the American political system. And what this has done, I mean, one of the interesting things is a guy who sort of likes politics as well as economics. One of the interesting things this has done is it's created a set of really strange bedfellows. For example, you find firms that are totally opposed to climate change, strongly supporting a carbon tax. And you ask yourself, that's nuts. Why are they doing that? And the answer is basically because of the fact that if you support a carbon tax and it gets cap and trade off the table so that that's no longer considered, then you put the carbon tax up and nobody votes for it. You have nothing, which is the preferred solution. So it's an interesting another. I don't mean to say that that's true for all supporters of carbon tax, because there are lots of reasons for a carbon tax. But it has created this unusual set of bedfellows, I think, which has been interesting to me. One of the differences between the system, too, is they both provide a form of policy stability, but the form is very different for the two systems. One provides stable prices, and one provides stable quantities, that is, the emissions reduced. Now, what's interesting is it used to be that people would say, well, that gives you a reason for preferring the tax. And the reason you prefer the tax is because you care about the cost a lot. And emissions reduction, I mean, this is going to take place over hundreds of years, so a few emissions here there, that doesn't make any difference. But then along comes Jim Hansen and Bill McKibben, who's basically on the same train, and they basically say, you know, 2 degrees makes a big difference. So that means that your emission reduction goals may matter, and you may not be indifferent as to whether you miss them by a lot or not, which means that cap and trade gets a nod in that kind of sense. What you hear, too, is that a carbon tax is basically easier to set up. I've gone through all of the decisions you have to make, and those are identical for the two, but there is one major difference, I think, administratively, and that is, whereas you just set a price in a tax, in the cap and trade, you have to actually establish a market. And this is an unusual market. I mean, there's not much normal trade in carbon. but there is now, and in fact, it's billions and billions of dollars in trade in carbon. So the question is the setting up of a market a distinction that really makes a difference between the two? And the one way to think about that is we've been doing these markets now, as I said, since 1975, and we've been doing them in a sophisticated way for the last sort of 10 years, since 1990. And we now have the software, we have the institutions and so on to handle that kind of thing. So even that is not a major difference. It's a difference, but I would submit it's not a major difference. Finally, I'd like to point out one distinction that I think is pretty subtle and has escaped a lot of people. And that is, if you want to treat people specially under a tax system, you give them an exemption. That means they don't pay the tax. If you treat people specially under an allowance system, you gift the allowance to them so they don't have to pay for them. But what I want you for a minute is to think about what the consequences of those two choices are. Put yourself in the shoes of an emitter. You're now facing a tax exemption. What kind of restrictions on your emissions are there? None. You don't pay the tax, and that's the only form of control. If you're gifted an allowance, what's the effect on your emissions? You still have to meet that cap. You still have to submit those allowances at the end of the year. So there is a quantitative limit on what you can emit. So there's a difference there. The final point I want to make before I quit is the question of where do all the other policies fit in? Some of my economist colleagues have been known to feel that all you need is a cap and trade or carbon and you can go home. The rest of the policies are absolutely unnecessary. I strongly do not believe that, and I think analysis says that that's not true. You need the complementary policies as well as the cap and trade. And let me give you just 2 examples of that, and then I'm going to quit and turn it over to Melissa to talk about the interesting stuff of the politics of the Markey bill. And that is that we know now that simply higher prices do not stimulate the right amount of energy efficiency. We've been studying this for a long time, and we know there's a lot of economists always say dollar bills lying on the sidewalk that nobody's picked up. And economists believe that somebody would pick them up. But darn it, they have not yet picked them up. And so the question is, what's going on there? Price is not enough. And part of this is the new behavioral economics that sort of argues that basically people frequently make decisions that are not in their own best interest. And energy efficiency is one of those. You can point out to a person, they can have an energy audit, and you can say, you would save an enormous amount of money by just investing a little bit in energy efficiency. And they say, oh, that's wonderful. And then they don't do it. So you need other policies like building standards and other things to encourage people to do that. The second one, and I could, this is actually a pretty long list of things not covered by cap and trade, but the other one is R&D, research and development. You may not know that research and development in energy in this country is very low, both by historic standards in this country, this is as a percentage of gross domestic product, but it's also low as a percentage of output relative to most other developed countries, industrialized countries. So that's, and that won't, cap and trade or carbon tax will stimulate R&D. There's no question about that. Will it stimulate enough? No. And so these complementary policies are necessary. Let me now turn it over to Melissa to talk a little bit about the new bill in Congress.
Good evening. Can everyone hear me all right? Okay. Thank you very much to the Harwood Center for hosting this forum tonight. My name is Melissa Carey, and I'm a climate change policy specialist at the Environmental Defense Fund, and I just want to note I got a huge promotion in the introduction. I don't lead all of our advocacy work on climate change, although I'd be very flattered to think that.
Tell your boss there's a debate
right.
coming.
send the bill. But I'm part of our national climate campaign. I'm part of our legislative team, and my work focuses on the Senate. EDF is a national nonprofit environmental advocacy group, and I'm very lucky in that I hold down a Washington-based policy job from my office in Falmouth, Maine. My job this evening is to give you a sense of the policy discussion on the ground at the national level in Washington. I'm going to talk to you about the American Climate and Energy Security Act, which passed the House of Representatives in June. I'll talk to you about what the bill does, what it doesn't do, and where things stand in the Senate going forward. And I'm going to stick to my 15 minutes because I'm looking forward to taking your questions afterward. So let's start with the House bill, and I'll frame this up for you a little bit before we get into the details. Does anyone here know when the first hearings on climate change were held in the Congress? Anyone want to take a guess?
76.
Well, you have an advantage, you know. It was 1976, over 30 years ago, that Congress held the first congressional hearings on greenhouse gases. The first real affirmative action came in 2003 when the Senate first voted, didn't pass, but just voted on a cap-and-trade bill sponsored by Senators McCain and Lieberman. It was mere 6 years later, at the end of June of this year, that the House of Representatives finally passed a climate bill. Climate action has been a long time coming. So, what did the House do, and how did they get it done? I'm actually going to address these questions in reverse order for the moment and just spend a second on how they got it done, because it really makes the remarkable nature of the bill that much clearer. This was a very heavy lift. You might think that the question of how they got it done is a simple one, because the Democrats are the majority party in the House, and we've all heard about the liberal House Majority Leader and how much Democrats love environmental issues and how terrible President Bush was on climate change and how he was, it was clearly time for a change. And I guess my response to those statements would be yes, yes and no. Climate legislation is very complex. It touches every source of emissions in our economy. And as such, it breaks down really over regional, not so much party lines. And so passing a bill involves negotiating really not just a maze, but a labyrinth of industry, consumer, environmental, regional, and political must-haves. It's a very, very complex job. I'll talk a little bit more about that theme toward the end of my talk and take the time now to go over what is in that bill. And just as an aside, the American Climate and Energy Security Act, also known as ACES, I'll start calling it ACES now because we'll need to mention that a lot. It's more than a cap-and-trade bill. It goes beyond that. It deals with some of the things that Tom just mentioned with efficiency standards and a renewable energy standard. I'm not going to address that now. I'm going to talk about the cap-and-trade part of it. So ACES, the American Climate and Energy Security Act, uses a cap-and-trade mechanism to achieve a declining limit on greenhouse gas emissions at 17% below 2005 levels by 2020 and 83% by 2050. The bill would put a national economy-wide cap on greenhouse gas emissions. That's the six greenhouse gases, not just CO2. By large sources, which are things like coal-fired power plants, large factories, natural gas suppliers, and fuels. The cap will be phased in over a few years on electricity and home heating oil, for example, in 2012, and on natural gas in 2016. Companies under the bill will need to have a permit called an allowance You can kind of think of this like monopoly money. It's the currency of the emissions market. And every year, the number of allowances available for all the covered sectors will shrink. That's the nature of the cap. Companies can trade allowances with each other, so whoever can reduce emissions most cheaply can profit by selling their excess allowances. And that's sort of the magic of the cap-and-trade approach. The bill allows banking of allowances, saving reductions for use in later years, and the use of carbon offsets, which are reductions in emissions from sources that are not included under the cap. The bill's 2020 pollution cuts would be equal to taking 500 million cars off the road, and those reductions would double by 2030. These are very big and very crucial reductions in greenhouse gases. What makes these reductions possible in a very large part is a closely negotiated set of rules about how emissions allowances, the currency of the cap-and-trade market, are to be distributed and how the proceeds from the sale of those emissions allowances are to be used. The provisions in this category, this is called the allocation provisions, really form the political and substantive center of the bill. This is where the rubber really meets the road in terms of negotiations. Excuse me. To minimize consumer impacts and to address concerns about how businesses will compete with companies and nations that have not capped their emission reductions, the bill gives away a very significant number of allowances for free in the early years. And here's a quick rundown of the major categories in this area. The first is consumers. The bill accounts for concerns over consumer energy bills by giving 39% of allowances in the first phase of the program to local electricity and natural gas companies and requiring those utilities to pass the benefits on to their customers. It also protects low and moderate income households by allocating 15% of allowances to minimize impact on those households. 1.5% of the allowances are reserved for home heating oil use. In the later years of the program, most of the allowances will be returned to the public through a broad-based tax refund. Some people call this the climate dividend or cap and dividend. Over the life of the program, this amounts to nearly one-fifth of the allowance value, the single largest category of allocation in the bill. Taken together, these provisions ensure that about 43%, or an estimated $570 billion of allowance value, will go direct to consumers through tax refunds and reductions in utility bills. The second major category for you to be aware of is trade-exposed industries. And what I mean by this are industries that produce a product that is considered a global commodity in which our manufacturers have to compete with their competitors in other nations and have to meet a global price. So these are things like steel, iron, rubber, glass, pulp and paper. ACES takes into account the concern over our domestic industries and whether they would be disadvantaged if production moved overseas to take advantage of a lack of carbon regulation in other nations. You've heard this before. What if we take a cap and China doesn't and all of our businesses move overseas to China? This is what this is about. The bill levels the playing field for energy-intensive industries like steel and concrete by giving them free permits or allowances that cover their direct and indirect emissions in the early years. And later on, if other nations don't take emissions targets, it would assess a tariff at our border that would ensure that the price of carbon is incorporated into that carbon-intensive good so that no nation gains an economic advantage by failing to take an emissions cap. Pulp and paper mills, as I mentioned, are among the energy-intensive trade-exposed industries covered by these provisions. Last is sort of a third category of other purposes. Small businesses receive 7% of the allowance value. Public purposes such as worker training, technical assistance, and clean energy R&D account for 27%. And just to sort of cap off this part of the description, when you add it up, nearly 80% of the allowance value over the life of the bill goes to households, small businesses, and for other public purposes. It's a pretty impressive number from where I sit. So I've given you a sense of what ACES does. It sets concrete near and long-term caps on greenhouse gases. It uses the market-based cap-and-trade mechanism to achieve the reductions. It allows emissions offsets. It has a combination of free allocation and auctioned emissions allowances. It returns a significant portion of the proceeds from the market to the public. And before I wrap up with a discussion of the politics, which is where it gets really interesting, let me just tell you for a moment what the bill doesn't do. The first thing it doesn't do is that the bill does not regulate small businesses. To be included under the cap, you have to emit 25,000 tons a year or more. Just to give you a sense of perspective, an old school gas-guzzling SUV, say an old Chevy Suburban, would emit about 2 or 3 tons per year. So this doesn't come anywhere near your average consumer or small business. A new report out by Duke University has shown, it's a great report. It gives you kind of a lookup table format to look at what the 25,000-ton threshold looks like in different industries. And Duke has shown that the 25,000-ton threshold touches just 1.3% of the manufacturing businesses in our country, and that 1.3% is responsible for about 80% of all manufacturing emissions. In other words, they're really getting their regulatory bang for the buck here. The second thing the bill does not do, the bill does not let other nations off the hook. This has been a primary concern of the Congress and of the public, and they do address it here. In the near term, the bill shields our domestic trade-sensitive industries through the free allowance provisions. In the longer term, it requires our economic competitors to factor in the price of carbon to their goods if they choose not to join us in capping emissions. No one gains an advantage by continuing to pollute. The last thing the bill doesn't do is that the bill doesn't cost a gazillion dollars. Last week, this is a very inside the beltway thing, but the listservs in D.C. were really lit up by a report that the Competitive Enterprise Institute, sort of a more conservative think tank, had dug up an old Treasury Department report on how much revenue would be raised through a theoretical 100% auction. The report trumpeted some sort of, you know, inside report from the Obama administration that a cap and trade bill would cost between $100 and $200 billion per year and crush our GDP. In fact, it was an old analysis of a proposal that was never embraced and would have been true anyway only if someone had gathered up all that cash and set it on fire on the White House lawn. What does it cost? All of the publicly disclosed analyses, and what I mean by that are peer-reviewed, transparent economic models that economists in different universities or in the public can look at and review. All of these models have concluded that the bill would cost something on the order of a postage stamp a day for the average American family, a dime a day per person, if you will. So different models, different assumptions, different institutions, strikingly similar results. So we know that this is an economically sound approach. So before we run out of time, let me shift and just talk a little bit about the road ahead. Passing the House bill was really a remarkable achievement. It's really real. The time has passed for message votes and marker bills and floor speeches that are just speeches. Everything that the members of the Senate do now has some real meaning. Just as an aside, a week or two ago, the Senate Majority Leader made an offhand comment to a couple of reporters that, well, the legislative session is 2 years long, so if we don't get the climate bill done this year, given how crowded the legislative calendar is, there's always next year. It was a complete international uproar. Newspapers around the world carried the majority leader's comment. He was really besieged by press wanting to know what was the meaning of this statement because of the climate talks coming up in Copenhagen. It's really a different atmosphere, and there's a real air of seriousness about it in Washington. So let me run down for you the major moving parts behind the scenes. And I'll cover this one first because I know it's one you're aware of, and that's the international pressure for a new climate treaty. The Kyoto Protocol has an expiration date, and the expiration date is 2012. So the world is gathering in Copenhagen, Denmark, this December, in a much-touted effort to forge a new climate treaty. The hope is that the United States, under new leadership, can help forge a new agreement. But there is no hope, none, of gaining significant participation from other nations, particularly, I mean, major emitting developing nations, without substantive American action on domestic greenhouse gases. So Copenhagen is providing some real diplomatic time pressure. The next big factor is one that's in hot dispute today, tonight, actually, as we speak. The Supreme Court has ruled that the EPA has the authority to directly regulate greenhouse gases. The EPA has indicated its inclination to move forward with this authority, but businesses across the board, perhaps not surprisingly to you, have cited a strong preference for congressional action over EPA regulation, and they've been pushing hard for a bill to pass before the EPA acts. So perhaps also not surprisingly, there's a movement afoot now in the Senate to pass a rider on an appropriations bill that would prevent EPA from using any congressionally authorized funding to actually make those rules on greenhouse gases. How this will come out is far from clear, but it is safe to say that the threat of EPA regulatory action is a significant spur to congressional action. The third part is that the coalition of the willing, so to speak, has become incredibly broad. In 2003, when we had the first vote on the climate bill in the Senate, there were comparatively few voices on the side of climate action. I can tell you from the environmental community's perspective, the fact that hunters and anglers and the faith community were joining us was really nothing short of revolutionary. We were really on top of the world. We did very well. We broke the 40-vote margin, which was a big deal in the Senate. But we just couldn't have imagined the picture today. The U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which is comprised of oil companies, auto manufacturers, electric utilities, environmental groups, and technology suppliers, is calling for deep emission cuts through a cap-and-trade program. Major industrial players like Duke Energy and PG&E have publicly dropped out of trade associations that oppose climate action. Even the environmental community, which I think I can say is famously short on tight coordination, has partnered with community groups, veterans organizations, and others to launch Clean Energy Works, a coalition representing 12 million members across the nation, and they're organizing to pass a climate bill this year. So that's the news on one side of the equation, but on the other side, we have some more sobering facts to consider. The Senate is doing health care. It's almost October, and there's precious little time left in the legislative calendar this year before Copenhagen. Healthcare, the majority leader has said, and it is abundantly clear, is going first. We also have the matter of the war in Afghanistan, financial market oversight, and by the way, we haven't yet passed a single appropriations bill to keep the federal government running through the next fiscal year. The clock is ticking loudly. Just as proponents of climate action are fired up, so are the opponents. As I said earlier, this is really real. There's nothing sort of the trial run is over. That's really done with. The stakes are very high, and there will be winners and losers. And the healthcare town hall meetings that were held this August, I'm sure you saw the coverage in the paper and on the news. Those were not the only places where lawmakers have been getting an earful from constituents. Earlier this month, over the Labor Day recess, Massey Energy, which is a huge coal employer in West Virginia, sponsored a Friends of America rally to protest climate legislation that featured country music headliners as well as Sean Hannity and Ted Nugent. During the vote on the House bill, farm radio across the Midwest was featuring commentators talking about a cow tax. This was the climate bill. It was a cow tax and the elimination of the family farm. The Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, despite the fact that a majority of businesses on its board support a cap-and-trade program, has passionately opposed this bill every step along the road, and is doing so very effectively at the grassroots level. They have forums like this, too. They're just a little bit different. The last thing, and this is really what I want to leave you with because it's the most important thing, is that regional divisions are very, very, very real. And in the Senate, where every state, regardless of population, has an equal vote, this makes passing a climate bill very different and a lot harder than it is in the House. The politics of climate change are not partisan. They are regional. They're even cultural. And if you thought partisan politics were tough these days, I will tell you that the regional divisions provide a multiplication factor that makes partisan politics, simple partisan politics, look almost friendly. Let me give you one example. Indiana. Indiana has one Republican and one Democratic senator. Senator Lugar, an enormously popular Republican, I think he won with 83% of the vote last time. Very senior Republican, longtime chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has been a very reliable Republican vote in the past on the McCain-Lieberman bills and other votes we've had in the Senate. His colleague, Senator Evan Bayh, Democrat, has also voted for the cap-and-trade bill in the past, twice. So we're good, right? Not so fast. Governor Mitch Daniels recently spoke about the climate bill this way. This is his quote. "Quite simply, it looks like imperialism. This bill would impose enormous taxes and restrictions on free commerce by wealthy but faltering powers, California, Massachusetts, and New York, seeking to exploit politically weaker colonies in order to prop up their own decaying economies. Because proceeds from their new taxes, levied mostly on us, will be spent on their social programs while negatively impacting our economy, we Hoosiers decline to submit meekly." So how are Lugar and Bayh going to vote? Indiana is a heavy manufacturing state that burns coal for a majority of its electricity. North Dakota, with two Democratic senators, is dominated by the lignite coal industry. West Virginia is where that Massey Energy rally was held. Two Democrats there. This is just not easy stuff. So I'm not ending on a down note, but on a very realistic note. The House made a major achievement in passing ACEs, but the job is far from complete. In a way, the real action has only just gotten underway. So it's time for me to wrap up, but I hope that we can spend some more time on these themes during question and answers. And I will turn it now over to Pete.
Good evening. Let me also thank the Hayward Center for sponsoring this event and also commend all of you for participating. I encourage you to stay involved in this issue. This is one of the most important issues of our time, and success depends on the involvement of people who care about the outcome. And the outcome of this process is uncertain. I was asked to discuss policies developed here in the state of Maine from the ground level, from the perspective of an advocate that's involved in the process, not just the climate policies, but the complementary policies on renewable energy and energy efficiency. And so how is Maine doing on this front? Actually, pretty well. The state of Maine is different from some of the states that were just mentioned. We have a reasonably progressive state legislature. We've had some terrific lawmakers, including one at the end of this panel, including a current one sitting in the front row, Peggy Rotundo, and we don't have very much coal extraction or generation in the state, although we do have coal that feeds into the mix here. So the Maine legislature has adopted some important and quite significant bills on energy efficiency, on renewable energy, particularly wind power. And we've also participated in passage of the REGI bill, which is probably the best cap-and-trade program that has been put in place anywhere. And that passed on a very significant bipartisan vote in both the House and Senate in the state legislature. It was a unanimous vote in the Maine Senate, so all Republicans voted for it. So despite the polarization that appears on the national landscape on cap and trade here in the state, the Republicans, actually some of them, were for it before they're now against it. There's some larger politics that are affecting their point of view now. So we seem to be moving generally in the right direction on energy policies and climate policies here within the state, but we have huge challenges ahead of us, also huge important opportunities, which I'll get into. At the outset, let me just remind us again of how big this climate challenge really is. Over the course of the next four decades, and most of us will be here then, I hope, the world needs to reduce greenhouse gases by 80%. This will require a complete transformation of our energy system away from carbon-based fuels across the entire planet. We will need to drastically cut our use of coal and oil while rapidly increasing wind power and solar power, other renewables, shifting to plug-in hybrids and vehicles that get 60 miles per gallon, and implementing energy efficiency and green building measures everywhere at absolutely unprecedented levels. So we need everybody to be involved in this process. And it's become increasingly clear that there's no single strategy that will do it all. No one has identified a silver bullet. So instead, we will need 10 to 20 different major strategies, each of which will be a 5 or 10% solution. An economy-wide cap on carbon emissions in the United States and an international climate treaty will be essential. These actions will provide the commitment, the structure, the rules, in both the pressure and the incentives necessary to get climate solutions implemented as fast as possible, as universally as possible. And we need to act quickly. As the chairman of the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said yesterday at the United Nations Climate Conference, current emission trajectories are speeding the world toward the panel's worst-case possibilities. Science leaves us, this is his quote, science leaves us with no space for inaction now. And carbon emissions are just one of the many impacts caused by electricity generation, as I think all of you know. Here in New England, as I mentioned, we do have coal generation. We're part of a large power pool, the New England grid, and there's 8,000 miles of transmission line, 350 different generating facilities that range from hydropower wind farms at one end of the carbon emission spectrum all the way up to coal and oil-fired power plants at the other end. And some of that coal comes from Appalachia. Some of the coal for the New England power plants comes from huge open-pit mines in Venezuela, in Colombia, and Indonesia. So the lights that we have perhaps in this building and certainly other power that we use here in the state of Maine does connect to mountaintop removal in Appalachia and pretty severe environmental impacts in geographies that are out of sight and out of mind. But we are culpable, and we are responsible for helping deal with these problems as well as the others. And there's a long list, as Ted mentioned, of mercury pollution, air pollution, public health impacts, toxic ash landfills, contaminated water supplies, habitat destruction. One can go on and on describing the environmental and community impacts and public health impacts of our energy generation and use system. And all of these harms could be lessened by reducing our dependence on fossil fuel. So in other words, the federal and international climate policies and state policies that are targeted at reducing carbon emissions also will reduce these environmental impacts while contributing to energy independence and economic security. So now specifically, what has Maine done in this regard? Well, let me just mention some of the policies that I think are quite significant and other actions. And I'll also mention some things happening in the private sector in terms of renewable energy development. In 2000, Maine's Governor Angus King joined with the other New England governors and Eastern Canadian premiers in adopting a joint agreement setting carbon emissions, calling for goals to set carbon emissions 10% below 1990 levels by 2020 and by 75 to 80% reductions by the middle of the century. That was quite a leadership move by the governors and New England premiers. In 2004, the Maine legislature adopted these goals in statute. Ted Kaufman was there. We worked with him to get that bill through. The bill faced some significant opposition, included from some out-of-state lobbyists that were funded by the coal industry that were pretending to be academics. Some of those people are still active today in the large group of finance deniers about the climate change problem. So that bill made us one of the first states in the nation to have goals in statute, quite aggressive goals for greenhouse gas reductions. In 2005, we adopted a climate action plan that flowed from that legislation. In 2007, the RGGI law was adopted, which has 100% auction. And those auctions are happening. Revenues are being generated. The funds are being spent. Over the next year, we will see some very significant investments by the industrial sector and others in reducing their energy costs through the investments of revenues that are raised through this cap-and-trade program. In 2008, Maine adopted new energy efficiency codes for new construction. We didn't really have a residential construction code. Now we have one of the best in the country. And we also passed quite a landmark wind power bill that established quite ambitious goals, 2,000 megawatts of installed wind power in the state of Maine by 2015 and 3,000 megawatts by the year 2020. And we're building wind power. The state of Maine, unlike most other states in New England, has moved ahead quite well with the construction of wind power projects, and others are coming along. And this year, 2009, the legislature enacted a major energy bill that consolidated all of the energy efficiency programs of the state, pulled them together, and set really ambitious goals for weatherizing homes. The goal is to weatherize all of Maine's homes, 477,000, by the year 2030, and half of our businesses. Maine is enormously dependent on home heating fuel, and the price shock of the summer, two summers ago, really scared people into realizing that we really have to do something to help people get off of their home heating bills and for us to stop wasting so much energy. And that will be a very difficult set of goals to meet, but we do now have some of the resources in place. This is one area where the state legislature fell short in putting the sort of resources necessary to help achieve that goal. But first you set the goal, and then you go back and hopefully get the resources necessary. So while these policies have been put into place, Maine also, as I mentioned, has been moving ahead with wind power development. We've been building many LEED certified buildings. We've been building good schools. We've been improving the housing stock. We've also been improving the general building stock. I think we probably have the highest percentage of hybrid drivers per capita in the country. And I think many people are doing the right thing to try to reduce their fossil fuel use. All of these measures do reduce our carbon emissions. So a lot has happened, but we have a long ways to go. A recent chart showed the carbon emissions for the New England states. It was going up in the 1990s. It was leveling off in recent years. And it has a steep slope that it needs to go down to get to the 80% reduction by 2050. Perhaps one of the most encouraging developments in Maine is the growing awareness of how clean energy development and energy efficiency investments could be a central role for our economic policies as a state moving forward. As we sit here, and as somebody also has mentioned, Governor Baldacci is leading a wind power trade mission in Europe with a number of Maine businesses, and that's quite an interesting development. And we hope that that helps contribute to renewable energy development within the state. And Maine has a stronger wind resource than all of the other New England states combined onshore. Then we also have a very significant offshore development. There are more than 300 companies in the state that have participated in the construction of wind farms already. So this is already something that an enterprise that's creating green jobs. I know that there's an abstraction out there about the millions of jobs that climate legislation will create. Well, when you actually look at it, it does really create a lot of weatherization jobs, retrofitting jobs, and construction of renewable energy projects. So this is real. There are also 1,000 companies doing energy home energy audits within the state, or weatherization, or green building, or renewable energy installations. A recent report by the Pew Trust suggests that Maine already has 6,000 clean energy jobs, with the largest segment, 42%, in energy efficiency. And over the last 10 years, this sector has grown 23% in the state of Maine, while our general economy and number of jobs has grown only by a few percent. Passage of federal climate legislation and an international climate treaty could be a boon for these clean energy jobs within the state. And I think the Maine legislature has begun to realize that. Earlier this year, there were 100 Maine businesses that sent a letter to Maine's congressional delegation calling for enactment of climate legislation this year. And that letter was very strong and said that our companies are ready to be part of the solution of converting to an energy system that does not generate as much impact on our climate. In Maine, if we are to develop 3,000 megawatts of wind power by 2020, that's more than $6 billion worth of capital investment. That's more investment on our horizon than we can think of in any other sector. Again, going back to my first point, this is a total wholesale conversion that we're talking about of how we generate and use energy. This is just one segment of it that I'm looking at, renewable energy. The same thing has to happen in terms of transportation and home heating. But we're not alone in this race for dominance of the clean energy economy and of the future. China's on track to pass the U.S. this year with the largest, with the world's largest wind farms. They're rapidly positioning themselves to capture the green energy economy. Six enormous wind power projects are under construction in China, each with a capacity of more than 16 large coal-fired power plants. More than 30 million homes in China now have solar hot water systems, accounting for two-thirds of the world's solar water heating. And Chinese companies are leading the global effort to drive down the cost of solar photovoltaics. On the one hand, this is good news, given the imperative for China to reduce its carbon emissions and move away from coal. But it seems dangerously reminiscent of other cases when the U.S. has lost its leadership position in key market segments. The U.S. built the first wind turbines and the first solar photovoltaics, and now we see statements like the following from a major solar company official quoted recently in the New York Times, quote, "I don't see Europe or the United States becoming major producers of solar products. They'll be consumers." This should make Maine and national policymakers jump to action. Maine is actually trying to jump to action in the area of deep offshore wind power development. The legislature this year directed the identification of a number of sites offshore to serve as testing locations for platforms and turbines for deep offshore wind power development. And the University of Maine is developing a national deep offshore wind research center. And companies like BIW, Bath Iron Works, are traveling with the governor today on this trade mission and seek to be major players if this technology does take off. If deep offshore wind does become a reality, it could mean thousands of manufacturing jobs here in Maine and a major impact on the climate emissions within the region. But the jury is out whether the policies, economics, and technology leadership will come together to make that particular vision happen. But at least we're trying to solve part of the climate problem in that fashion. For those of you who have been involved in advocating for federal climate in various ways already, I really commend you to stay involved. This has been a time of tremendous excitement, nervousness, and frustration, but it really is one of the most significant, most momentous policy debates of our times. And for it to be a success, you need to stay involved, so please do. And thank you again for coming out tonight.
I want to thank all of our panelists. We've got some time for questions and responses. And while folks are gathering their thoughts, I have a quick question from Melissa or anyone else who can help. I hadn't understood in the current cap and trade legislation the limit of 25,000 tons per year in terms of who comes under the cap. Does that mean that for automobile drivers, there's no incentive in the system to buy cleaner cars, or how does that get passed along down to consumers in terms of their incentives?
In the transportation sector, transportation fuels are covered under the cap. So that's When I mentioned the 25,000-ton threshold, that applies to stationary sources, literally sources that don't move around, sources with a smokestack. In the transportation area, it's fuels are included under the cap.
Thanks. Let me throw the discussion open to others and just ask that you wait till you get to me with the microphone.
All right. Thank you very much for coming here. I'm wondering how ACES is going to affect REGI and already established regional greenhouse gas initiatives around the country. Will it absorb it? Or
The way it looks now, that bill would have a federal preemption, which means that REGI would cease to exist. However, it's not quite as bad as that seems. There are two provisions that make the transition smoother than that seems. One is that there's a provision to transfer existing REGI allowances into federal allowances based on the relative costs of those two, which is a reasonable way to do it, I think. So it would preserve the incentive under REGI to keep controlling. The second thing is that the states got together and basically said, we have a lot of energy efficiency being funded by this revenue, and if you do away with our system, that really causes problems with energy efficiency. So the bill actually contains in it a substantial amount of revenue to flow toward energy efficiency. And my guess is that would flow through states to a large extent. So it's not clear to me that although REGI would likely cease to exist, that would be a serious problem, actually.
Let me just quickly add that the Congressional Budget Office has done some calculations of what the efficiency investments would be that flow through the various states. And a group, Energy Environment Northeast, has looked closely at what that would mean for the state of Maine. And their estimate is that total energy efficiency investments through the ACES bill to the state of Maine would be $878 million over the period 2012 to 2019, which is greatly in excess of what would happen through the REGI program. And that level of investment would just be absolutely enormously beneficial for this state, generating jobs and driving down energy costs for consumers, and it would have tremendous benefits. So people who have looked closely at the ACES bill understand this would be really huge for energy efficiency in Maine and across the country.
For comparison purposes, REGI generates about $15 million a year, so those are much bigger numbers.
I've got one more question. All of you in one way or another have spoken to the challenge of the climate change problem and the need for a really, systemic transformation of the way we live. Melissa also made an eloquent case for the value of ACES as it's been passed. But I'm still not sure, listening to this, whether we're confident that it's big enough to do the job. Do we think that if magically some version of the bill is passed in the House, was passed and became law, it's at a scale that's large enough to do the transformational work that you've been talking about?
My response to that is that no policy is likely to do the job by itself. I think what you're likely to witness is that this is the first step in an evolution. And I think a kind of what we're going to do is we're going to set these things out, we're going to try them, we're going to see how it works, and then we're going to adjust. And I think it will require continual adjustment. I think anyone who thinks that we know all the answers between now and 2050 is pretty naive. That's a very complex problem. So what you have to do is you have to develop a system that sets you on the right road. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with but the first step, and I think that's true in this case. I refer to it as the camel's nose under the tent.
You mean that in a good way.
I do that. Mean that in a good way. Yes.
I'd just add, too, that the bill itself recognizes this fact and contains scientific review provisions that require independent scientific review of the targets and timetables on an ongoing basis over time, and contains provisions to drop the limits or otherwise amend the program as the science dictates. I think everyone understands that will be needed over these long time scales.
maybe to follow up a little bit on this regional dynamic within the national debate, one of my concerns, and I'm Jonathan Labonte with the Andrew Scoggin Land Trust, and we work in this region looking at land conservation issues and opportunities, and certainly land use planning at the local level in Maine is driven by home rule, and nearly 500 municipalities all deriving what their 30 to 60 square miles might look like. Within that framework, if everyone drove a hybrid and everyone lived in an energy efficiency single-family home on a 2 to 3 acre lot as we continue to grow out, is that really a story of sustainability in this new world order of climate change? And this dynamic of, I think there was a comment made that people don't often make decisions in their own best interest, and you often have to move away from audits and letting them know how they could save money to a dynamic of standards and regulations. Is Maine likely needing to look at a different future of land use planning on a larger scale that would allow opportunities for real meaningful public transit and real meaningful efficiency and sustainability? Is the way we've developed over the last 15 years really a way we can continue to develop sustainably?
Good point. I'd like to weigh in just a little bit. There have been a number of perverse subsidies supporting sprawl in the state of Maine and elsewhere. And of course, it's a challenge to create policies that tell people where they can live or not live. But there could be some disincentives, for example. We spend a lot of money developing state highways to get people away from our urban areas. Our urban areas, which provide most of the services, have the highest taxes because they don't have the tax base and the tax collections. So people living outside of our urban areas are enjoying the benefits of the services we provide and by our higher taxes. And those higher taxes, of course, are driving people out to low tax rate communities. Where we build, what we build, and how we relate our homes to work, to school, to community, that whole smart growth phenomenon is, I think, critical. It's, of course, terribly challenging to accomplish. But we need to deal with that. When we talk about transformation, I think it has to be fundamental throughout our society. It doesn't mean it has to be great sacrifice. But there's a certain discipline to all of this, and we're a peculiar sort of country around that sort of discipline that would, you know, on a communal basis, we're so attached to our independence and individuality. It's a challenge to change the way we do things and create some conformity around disciplined planning and how we structure things in our society.
That actually seems like a wonderful note to end on. I want to thank all of you for coming. It's been a real education, and we're really grateful for you for teaching us. Thanks.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on climate change that took place recently at Bates College in Lewiston. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.